You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on January 12th, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me as usual. Our top story continues our coverage of the escalating Boko Haram campaign in northern Nigeria. Our second segment this week is an in-depth discussion of the French historical and political context surrounding the Charlie Hebdo attacks. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again, as usual, is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Our first story is going to be out of Nigeria. This is obviously a topic that we've been covering a lot in the past several months. I feel like in many ways more than most media programs. And we're, you know, looking at the threat from Boko Haram, looking at the upcoming Nigerian elections, that sort of thing. But obviously the top line story is that as many as 2,000 people are feared dead in a string of attacks last week in northeastern Nigeria, in the northern part of the state of Borno. And these were pretty horrific attacks, but they also kind of capped off a sort of escalating series of attacks across both northeastern Nigeria and some of the neighboring countries that didn't really get all that much attention, I felt, from many media outlets. You know, there would be kind of a little bit of a story here and there, but certainly nothing major. You know, I do want to caution that in defense of the media, some of these things can be a little bit hard to verify. In fact, we've done a segment before on this show about how there's a lot of unreliable information that comes out of Nigeria concerning this insurgency. You know, however, these are reports from firsthand observers, people who said that they saw that these attacks happen or were there on scene in the immediate aftermath. So those seem to be a little bit more reliable. But, you know, on the other hand, as I think we also talked about before, you know, Nate talked about the sort of cutbacks on foreign bureaus around the world for various media outlets. And there's very little staff in place in Nigeria, despite the fact that it's the, you know, a very large country with the most most population in all of Africa.
Yeah, I'd just say one of the few outlets I would still say has a presence in Lagos, for example, would be BBC article. I'm just looking here on the computer, just talking about how there were suicide bombers as young as 10 years old in this market attack, a couple female suicide bombers. So it seems like there might have been even like a new escalation to a new level of, you know, we've seen this, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, various types of female suicide bombing, just be less suspicious of it after a while in the conflict, maybe, you know, just trying to throw new new tactics in there. So it just seems like there might have been a new level reached recently.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this is a clear trend that's been proceeding. That's why I don't find it that difficult to believe that this happened, because it fits directly with a pattern that we've been seeing lately. You know, a couple weeks ago there was a very large attack on a base in Cameroon, which is the country next door. This is an area in Nigeria that we're talking about is right near the border with Cameroon and with Chad. And the Boko Haram basically went across the border and attacked a military base in Cameroon, and then they captured that very briefly. And then Cameroon said that they had to, you know, order missile strikes on the site and, you know, scramble aircraft. I'm not sure what aircraft, because Cameroon has a really, really bad air force that's very small and very old. But we, you know, that sort of showed that Boko Haram was starting to put really large operations into place that required, you know, several thousand fighters to hit multiple targets at one time, as opposed to just doing, you know, little suicide bombings here and there. And then, you know, about a week or so later, maybe a little bit more, We then saw an attack on the Nigerian military base at Baga, and this is in Borno State, in the northern part of Borno State. And what happened there, this was a multinational force was stationed there specifically for countering Boko Haram. It had forces from Cameroon, I don't think Chad, but possibly, and some forces from Niger had been there previously, although I think they were not there at the moment. And what we then saw coming out of this event here was that the base was captured very easily by Boko Haram. The multinational force just fled completely, didn't put up any resistance, according to all the accounts that we've been hearing from the locals. And thousands of people fled, something like 2,000 people or so fled across the border to neighboring Chad. They had to get in boats and go across Lake Chad. And so, you know, and it's possible that in some of these attacks in the area around Baga, that when we say that we have 2,000 people dead or unaccounted for, it may be that some of them are just, you know, displaced to somewhere else or in hiding and they're not actually dead. But the what we've essentially been hearing is that in the five-day span following the fall of the Baga military base, which was the last government outpost in the northern part of Borno State, residents said that at least 16 villages were burned to the ground. 2,000 people were unaccounted for and feared dead, and that these villages that had been destroyed were just, quote, covered in bodies, and the local defense, self-defense forces that have been sort of forming gradually in the past year or so had basically given up count because there were too many bodies. And so this marks one of the biggest single atrocities that we've seen, I think, in the world in quite some time. You know, even Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, they killed only 2,000 people, not only, but, you know, over the course of an entire year, they killed 2,000 people in 2014 in, you know, execution style attacks. And so this is a very significant attack. And again, we don't have completely hard numbers on this, but this is certainly marking a trend, as Nate said. And this, you know, and then following up, we saw this horrible suicide bombing with a 10-year-old girl in Maiduguri, which is the state capital of Borno, and it's further south, and has also been a previous target for Boko Haram attacks. So this is kind of the direction that we're heading now. But this horrible atrocity last week, where 16 villages were destroyed and a major military base was captured, you know, as many as 2,000 people were killed and you know, thousands displaced. So this is kind of what we're looking at right now. Nate, what were your thoughts on this story and the trends that we've been seeing in recent weeks?
Yeah, I just wanted to put a quick point in there, as there's been recent reports, I guess, going back to June, saying Britain would increase its military and educational aid to Nigeria to, you know, fight Boko Haram, and that includes counterinsurgency training. And the U.S. military is also getting involved in this, but apparently Nigeria has criticized the U.S. for refusing to sell it weapons because of alleged human rights abuses committed by Nigerian troops. So we're reaching a situation, I guess, you know, as we've talked about, where, you know, we're not necessarily trusting in the government forces or the actual, you know, regular army. We're dealing with various militants and militias out in the countryside. There's no sort of state recognized military force or police force that could actually enforce some semblance of law and order. So we're sort of left in a situation where, you know, if we're not trying to go in sort of a targeted special operation against Boko Haram, if we're not doing that, then we're sort of at a severe, I wouldn't say disadvantage, but it's almost impossible to do anything concrete, really. So it just, it's a very difficult situation, it seems like.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of parallels to be drawn with the situation regarding Iraq and Syria, of having to look at the role that government abuses have played in this, government and military incompetence have played in this situation. Time magazine reported that Boko Haram now controls, quote, an estimated 30 to 35,000 square kilometers, roughly the same amount of terrain in Syria and Iraq that Islamic State controls. we've also seen that as recently as 2013, there was a massacre in the same exact area in right around Baga in Borno State, and that was conducted by the government military forces that were supposedly there to rescue people from Boko Haram, and they killed a lot of civilians there. Not anywhere near as many as this, but still a very significant number. And that's been a problem that we've talked about previously on the show, especially when we had our guest expert Pilar Kazer on to talk about this. A lot of these sort of gains by Boko Haram have been closely associated with these atrocities first by government or abuses by government forces. And so, you know, when Nigeria asks for quote unquote help from the United States, like military assistance, donations or sales of various military equipment, that's why the United States hesitates. On the other hand, we don't seem to hesitate very much when we're giving those weapons to a lot of the other neighboring forces. Niger also decided to pull out of the multinational force in Nigeria. They do not want to participate anymore after the past week's events. Their basic excuse for this was that they said that the security situation was deteriorating too much. The foreign minister said, "We have 50 soldiers there," and decided to withdraw then after Boko Haram captured some other town back in October and continued to operate in the area with impunity. As you know, Baga is under the control of Boko Haram terrorists, and unless the town is recaptured from them, we will not send back our troops. So they're basically refusing to participate in a multinational force because they might have to fight Boko Haram. Like, they don't want to do the job that they've been sent to do. Niger has participated in like multiple trainings every year with the United States military as part of the, you know, Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative, which is an outgrowth of things that were developed shortly after 9/11 by the United States. Similarly, neighboring Chad basically refusing to participate in this situation. They're now one of the largest military forces in all of sub-Saharan Africa, and they have very close relations with the United States military, despite repeatedly ignoring every single U.S. request about human rights or even oil pipelines or literally anything. They just don't listen to the United States. They take our money, they take our training, and then they don't do anything, you know, that we want them to do, which, I mean, maybe we're asking them some unreasonable things, but I think some of them have been fairly reasonable requests and they've just blown us off completely. And they're one of our biggest partners in the region and they're refusing to participate in this. So again and again, we're seeing that United States policy in Africa is not working. It's just dramatically backfiring and is not resulting in anything useful. Even when the U.S. sent the surveillance drones to Chad to fly over northern Nigeria and try to find those kidnapped girls earlier this year, apparently the U.S. pulled out its drone team from Chad within about 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, and apparently there's just still bodies and violence lying around in some areas of I think it's Kano, because apparently there was an attack there maybe like a week ago. And there were just people firing rocket launchers and all sorts of stuff, you know, people fleeing immediately. And as you said, there was the death tolls may have been over 2,000, just incredibly high totals. So there's really not a lot that's going on to being stopped or to stopping these guys. And at the same time, you know, they don't really look like they're sort of ready to slow down anytime soon. So this is, you know, we've got people swimming across Lake Chad, apparently, to try to flee them, swimming to islands. You know, obviously, malaria is a pretty big concern. So once you start having these refugees, that creates a problem as well. It's just once, you know, you sort of have a small event that displaces people, it seems like sometimes, especially in a lot of these very, you know, resource poor areas or areas with not great healthcare in Africa, it just seems like a humanitarian crisis just starts to snowball a little bit. And then one thing connects to another. And then just before you know, there's thousands of people without food or, you know, medical supplies or, you know, living in camps or something. So,
yeah. And honestly, at this point, like the risk of contagion, so to speak, from this problem seems to be worse than the risk of contagion from Ebola. And think about the relative like amount of coverage that Ebola got in the United States, you know, in West Africa compared to what we're seeing here. I mean, this is this.
Well, I don't know if Boko Haram can infect white people, Bill. So
that's probably true. I mean
that probably explains it.
That's certainly, we can't overlook that as a potential factor for sort of how the coverage has been shaped. And again, like I said, some of it's a lack of information and reporters on the ground, although that's not really justifiable either to some extent. But yeah, this is.
I mean, considering we're doing a podcast about it, you know, in Massachusetts. I mean, there's not really an excuse to not cover it.
That's true. Yeah, the New York Times and CNN and all those people should have a lot more presence there. I mean, yeah, like Nate said, we've basically had to rely a lot of the time on reports from BBC News because they're one of the few people that has correspondence.
I mean, they actually have people in Lagos. So
yeah, they have people in Lagos, which is on the complete other side of the country, and then they also have, you know, they periodically send people up to Kano.
What I'm saying is it's a fairly large African city, and they actually have like a news bureau there, which I think a lot of international news organizations have started pulling away to the point where, like, I don't even think that they have news bureaus in Lagos, which is, isn't it like the largest city in Africa?
I believe so. Yeah.
So, I mean, that sort of tells you what you need to know right there.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of, I get frustrated. We talk a lot about Nigeria on the show. We talk a lot about Nigeria on arsenalfordemocracy.com. I get frustrated by how much Nigeria gets overlooked by not just the media, but by so much of the rest of, like, you know, big Hollywood or publishing companies, like that kind of thing. There's a huge movie industry in Nigeria. There's a huge audience for books. And, you know, they should be opening bureaus, not just of CNN or whatever, but they should be opening Lagos bureaus for major publishing houses. They should be opening, you know, divisions for major Hollywood studios. All these different companies could be making so much money and, you know, helping, like, it would be so easy to provide, you know, jobs and development and all these things. And we've seen that there's a willing and ready market to buy and consume all these things. And it's, you know, from these sort of pop culture side to the violence side, there's just no attention being paid to Nigeria, even though it's this huge country with so many people, such diversity, such amazing history, and all these other great things. And then also all these terrible news events, and they don't get nearly as much coverage as, you know, say ISIS or whatever, even though we're seeing a lot of the same patterns being repeated there, the same, you know, amount of land area controlled, the self-defense forces springing up, these responses to government abuses, all these sort of things that it has in common. And we don't see that kind of attention there. But, you know, so I just encourage people to keep paying attention to the situation in Nigeria, not just about this horrible atrocity, but also just keep on paying attention to what's been happening, because there's a very long sort of arc of development happening here. And the presidential elections are coming up in just a few weeks. And unfortunately, some of the areas that have been hardest hit by bad and incompetent government policies, these areas in the north, are finding that they're going to have to suspend their elections because the security situation is just too bad. I mean, 70% of the entire state of Borno has fallen under control of Boko Haram. And, you know, some of these areas are the ones that have been hurt the most by, you know, government atrocities and abuses. So, you know, it may be that the Nigerians do not end up voting out the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, even though, as we've talked about many times on the show before, he's proven quite incompetent and unable to meet the challenge in the north. All right, well, stick around. Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to pivot now to the situation in France and take a critical look at Charlie Hebdo and sort of the reactions that we've seen to the attacks that were there. You know, the bottom line here is that nobody deserves to get brutally murdered like that. Terrorism is bad, and we know all of that. But there is sort of a wider context that's being missed, I think, in a lot of U.S. media. Nate and I both took French for many years in school. We, you know, avid studying of French history. You know, I have a friend in France who's part of the political scene there, who's been on the show before. And this is something that when things like this happen, we look at it through more of a sort of a broader lens of French history and French politics that sort of gets missed by the U.S. Media and people commenting on this, because they're looking at it from a U.S. perspective and not really getting some of that full context. So I think it's important to look at some of that. So, Nate, why don't you kind of go over the background of what factually happened here, and then we can kind of talk about sort of the surrounding context.
Yeah, well, I'm not actually 100% sure about the backgrounds of some of these, the guys that busted into the Charlie Hebdo offices during an editorial meeting and killed, was it 12 people there? From what I heard, that these guys had, they would like train in Paris parks, like do various calisthenics and stuff, like as part of their just sort of training. I heard that there was some issues where they were involved in getting French Muslims to go fight in Iraq and Syria. So, you know, they were, you know, definitely involved in that. Apparently they spent time in prison and sort of their radicalism had hardened. This is something you see in, you know, a lot of criminals around the world, just like spend time in prison with other criminals, you're going to become more of a criminal. I mean, that's just sort of what happens. And we had, I guess, the first attack, they came in and started massacring people. And then there was a later an attack on a Jewish supermarket or a delicatessen or something, not in Paris though, right? It was a different
city. Yeah. Well, there were basically multiple attacks happening, 'cause one of their other friends from prison also decided to like take a, you know, start a hostage situation. So there were two hostage situations happening in two different places. It was a whole chaotic thing in sort of the greater metro Paris area.
Yeah. And there's a situation where they took some hostages, and luckily a large number of people ended up being saved by a I guess he was like the store clerk, just like some this guy was he Tunisian or
he was from Mali.
Mali, okay, that's right. Yeah, Mali. And so, you know, French Muslim, just working at the store that day and ended up getting a lot of people into the freezer in the basement, I believe, you know, packed everyone in there, turned it off, and, you know, just waited for everything to die down. Eventually, I guess they raided the store and came and got, and killed the guy. So they were able to, you know, be safe because of that. But, you know, fortunately more people weren't killed through the action of the store clerk that day. So that's, you know, yeah, at least one positive come out of this. And of course the fact that he's Muslim is significant, because we're showing that, you know, this is more about the terrorists than about the Muslim menace lurking under the surface of French society, which, you know, there's so many Muslims in France that it's just stupid to assume that, you know, any significant portion of them even are radicalized. Yeah. They're just more, the vast majority of them are going to be going about working their jobs, you know, at the store, and then all of a sudden these terrorists burst in and start taking everyone hostage, including the Muslim store clerk. So
yeah, and also outside of Charlie Hebdo in the initial attack, the on-duty police guarding the magazine, because it's been a controversial magazine in the past that has received various threats, so they had a permanent guard detail. The police officer that was shot and killed on video outside of that, he was also a Muslim guy who was, I believe, a French citizen. You know, this, like Nate said, this just goes to show that there's a much more nuanced picture than what came out of this. Also, I want to touch on the fact that, as Nate brought up, that about the radicalization that happened in prison and the recruiting angle. So at least one of these guys had been previously convicted specifically of recruiting terrorists to go join up, become terrorists, and go fight the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Okay, this was something they were, you know, radicalized by. There were rumors that they had been radicalized by, like, Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay or something like that. You know, like, that the notion of that was what made them decide to become terrorist recruiters. So I think that what should be taken into account here before everyone reacts, I think it's a little bit too late now, unfortunately, is that these guys are terrorist recruiters. they wanted to do something that would create a huge, huge reaction, both in France and in the rest of Europe, as well as in the United States, against Muslims in general. This was not, I have trouble believing that this was solely that they were so offended that they wanted to take out this magazine at all costs and, you know, kill off all these guys. Like, I have trouble believing that that was their primary motivation. I sincerely believe that they were essentially banking on the fact that by doing this, they would provoke a huge anti-Muslim reaction, especially in the context of, as we talked about just on last week's episode, of these anti-Muslim rallies that have been emerging in Germany, these huge record-breaking rallies against Islam and Islamification of Europe. They want to get as big a reaction against Muslims as possible because they know that that's what's going to drive radicals, you know, young, you know, malleable youth within Islam to go join up in, you know, as terrorist organizations. This is another example of an attack where it's not immigrants that are doing it. It's not this foreign, you know, threat or whatever. These are homegrown people. We saw this in, you know, in attacks in Britain and in various other places where there are citizens who grew up there, they're native born, they've lived there their whole life, and for their whole life they've been told that they're trash, they've been told that they're not, you know, full citizens, they've been told that they don't count, that they're not French or they're not European or they're not British or whatever, and they keep getting this message their whole life, which is what is pushing them out to the margins. Everyone kind of goes through that phase, you know, when they're, you know, in their teens or early 20s. Pretty much everyone goes through those moments, especially if they're having issues like unemployment or something like that. You go through those moments of being like, I'm just so angry at everything right now. I'm just so angry at the world. And, you know, not everyone goes down like a really radical path as a result of that. But if someone catches you at that right moment where you're susceptible to a message like that, and you have that context in your head of feeling like I've been attacked for my whole life, that's going to make it very easy to recruit you. And so what they're doing with an attack like this, you know, even if it's a suicide attack, they know that there's already been this large wave of recruitment happening for people to join ISIS or Nusra Front coming from Western Europe. And these typically aren't immigrants that are, you know, going back. These are first or second generation people who live in these countries and have been pushed out to the margins by the dominant part of society. As Nate mentioned, France is the country in Europe that has the largest Muslim population, but it's still dramatically less than what, you know, even French citizens seem to believe that the percentage of the population is. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it's something, you know, it's like less than 1 in 5. And I think by a significant margin. But the perception is always, oh, we're being invaded, we're being taken over. And There is a much longer French historical context here that we have to take into account. You know, Charlie Hebdo claimed that they were, you know, satirical magazine, that they were anti-racist, that they're left-wing. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in detail, but I think that there's a lot of questions to be raised as to whether or not they were actually satirists or actually anti-racist rather than just, like, you know, fueling the problem. I mean, at minimum, even if they sincerely believed that they were satirizing things, that, you know, speaking truth to power, and that they were, you know, that they didn't, you know, they weren't trying to promote racism, I think that there's a major risk that when you put out something like that, there's going to be a segment of the population that doesn't take it as satire and takes it at face value. I mean, you know, we saw early in the years of the Colbert Report where conservatives and Republicans didn't get that he was making fun of them and thought, oh, yeah, this, like, really extreme Republican agrees with all of my views. And you have to be careful about a situation like that. With Colbert, that doesn't really matter. It's a very low-stakes situation, right? Nobody's being hurt by that. But with something like this, if you're putting out caricatures about Islam that basically look like the same non-satirical caricatures that you would have seen 100 years ago or so, there's always going to be a segment of the population that's like, yeah, this magazine really gets me. They're willing to say what no one else is willing to say. And that's the thing. Satire is sort of fundamentally supposed to be targeting people who are really full of themselves or have a lot of power or are arrogant, that kind of thing. Satire is not really supposed to be, you know, punching downward on sort of an already marginalized population. You know, they'd say, oh, well, we're speaking out against extremist Islam and that kind of thing. And it's like, okay, but there are Muslims all across the Middle East who are publishing satire against ISIS and groups like that. And it's much, much funnier satire. I've seen some of it before, you know, even before this had happened. And like, they're risking their lives to put that content out, as opposed to Charlie Hebdo. It turns out they were risking their lives, but in general, they were operating in a pretty low stakes environment for their own personal risk.
Yeah, there's actually a fascinating article I'm reading about from Kanan Malik, who I guess is a professor of ethics, lecturer. And basically he talks about how, as you mentioned, that, you know, it's there are, you know, Muslim cartoonists and, you know, actually facing, you know, they're living in Pakistan. So we've got people like Pakistani cartoonist Sabir Nazar, Bangladeshi writer Tasmila Nazreen, people who are getting death threats, being exiled, Iranian blogger who was sentenced to death last year for insulting the prophet. So we have these instances, you know, of Muslim cartoonists who are, and Malik makes this point, who, you know, every day are sort of going against, standing up for equal rights and, you know, various types of democratic freedoms, freedom of speech, all these type of things that, you know, are now being celebrated and lauded in association with the Charlie Hebdo magazine. But at the same time, these people are not really getting, you know, they're not really being paid attention to, they're not really being viewed as. And so, and some of their maybe social messages probably are probably going to be a little more insightful, cutting, just closer to the actual truths on the ground, maybe, than just people in a in Paris writing about it, you know, sort of having these shock covers. It seems like, you know, they're trying to sort of spark a debate, grab attention, grab readership. There's that. So just, you would like to see maybe some of the other examples of people fighting against a sort of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, anti-cartoon sentiment, I guess, in some Muslim countries. And there are Muslims fighting against it as well. And that story should be told as well.
Right. And I don't know exactly what they thought they were adding to the debate, so to speak, or the discourse by being, you know, a bunch of white French guys with not that much familiarity with Islam and saying like, oh, well, we're going to use, you know, stereotypical caricatures, you know, either the prophet or, you know, a hook-nosed, swarthy, bearded gentleman in a turban. Like, those, you know, these are offensive stereotypes, whereas that satire coming out of the Middle East or coming out of Pakistan, coming out of North Africa, as Nate said, they are much more familiar with what they're trying to parody, and it's the, you know, surrounding culture around them. They know who the actual target should be. They know who to target, as opposed to just targeting sort of generic Muslim terrorist man or whatever. And, you know, the other problem here is that, so it's one thing if you're from inside the culture and you're satirizing it and you're satirizing the people in power there. It's a completely different thing if you're a white French guy in a predominantly white, you know, still French dominated French society, and you're satirizing this thing, because they tried to say, oh, well, we're equal opportunity. You know, we go after Christians as well. And it's like, okay, but most people in France are at least culturally, if not practicing, Catholics. So that's a fair thing for you to bring up, but it's not quite the same weight to bring up, you know, similar sort of attacks on Islam. And they also went after Islam pretty disproportionately in this sort of context of these rising Islamophobic sentiments. There's no widespread fear of the Catholic Church or the Pope or whatever in Europe, right? But there is a widespread fear of Islam. So they're working in two completely different contexts here and sort of failing to acknowledge that, which is why I have trouble buying this notion that, oh, well, they were really the anti-racists, or they're really, you know, whatever. They're not speaking truth to power. They're basically punching down on their own immigrant minority and immigrant descended minority.
Well, and when they talk about how they claim to attack everyone equally, you sort of just look at some of these covers and it's like, all right, well, there's a lot of covers about Muslims here, so is that equal? I mean, that's just my question. I mean, I have not read necessarily every issue of the magazine over the past, you know, several decades, but you sort of think, you know, there's been controversy, as you said, involving this magazine before. There was the massive controversy over the Danish cartoons that happened, and I think maybe Charlie Hebdo released some cartoons around the same time, if I recall correctly.
And they might have even reprinted those.
Yeah,
ones,
exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's one of the good points that it's made by some of these articles that I'm reading here. There's another excellent post on Hooded Utilitarian, just sort of engaging with the ideas of not necessarily disparaging the magazine, but saying that we should really be thinking about actually how this magazine went about its satire. And I'm using satire a little loosely here, because just drawing questionable cartoons of people, I wouldn't necessarily is always satire. But, you know, it just, we need to think about both in terms of how we, you know, express ourselves in terms of, you know, we don't want to be self-censoring. We want to have people feel free to draw whatever cartoons they want. But at the same time, you have to think about how, if you're working to reinforce sort of a status quo, if you're trying to have these cartoons that are sort of just poking the most disenfranchised minority in your country, you know, that shouldn't necessarily be wrong just out of, you know, complete cloth. You should be allowed to do that, but you have to think about how you're doing it sometimes. You have to think, is this actually engaging a social issue and furthering a discussion, or is this just, you know, poking people that, you know, might not take it all that well and lead to sort of a continued climate of, you know, distrust and just sort of under the surface racism. Yeah. Because as we all know, race doesn't actually exist in France, so therefore there can be no racism.
Right. Well, we'll get back to that sort of questionable notion as well shortly. But, you know, to Nate's other point there, right, like, obviously there are some people who are just super unhinged and insecure about their religion, and those people are found in all religions all over the world, right? And if you publish any sort of cartoon, like, that's enough to be like, this disrespect is so, you know, I gotta go fight someone. But, like, you can make fun of those people or whatever, but we also know guys who are gonna drive 40 minutes to Temecula to go fight someone on Twitter who insulted Kobe Bryant because, you know, I personally take that against my religion of Kobe, right? So,
Kobe-ism.
Like, Kobeism, you know, so we've seen this before where, like, all over the world where people will take something and just blow it out of proportion, right? But there's also just a large, much more, you know, moderate segment of the population that isn't necessarily like, oh, my religion can't take it if you draw a cartoon about it. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, no, this is a symbol of the oppression that has been kind of brought down upon us. This, you know, in France, it's the marginalization of the immigrant communities. In the Middle East, even where they, you know, are in a majority position, feeling very powerless about the fact that, like, you know, the United States can rain down hellfire missiles in, you know, Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen and, you know, all these different places. They can do bombing runs without, you know, over Syria without international approval. Just this sort of, there's no checks and balances even from the national governments to prevent these violations of sovereignty, these constant attacks. It feels like they're constantly under pressure. You know, with France specifically, you've got the whole history of colonialism, which I'm going to circle back to in about a minute. But, you know, France itself really, really has this dangerous conception, self-conception. There's, you go back to in AD 732, the Battle of Tours, right? This was something that was, you know, right at the time, maybe it was a huge deal, but it was sort of exaggerated importance in like the 18th and 19th centuries as that sort of colonial history starts. What happens at the Battle of Tours is that there are the Umayyad armies. These are conquering, you know, Muslim dynastic armies that had moved all the way across North Africa. They had moved up through Spain. They had basically conquered all of Spain. And they go into France, and there's this huge battle. It's a very important sort of formative battle for creating the centralized French state. Charles Martel was the hero of that. He's, you know, sort of sets the stage for Charlemagne and everything that comes after that. And, you know, he had to do a whole bunch of important reforms like that affected sort of the balance of power between the central state and all the, you know, aristocrats, just so he could get enough horses to do this battle. So this is a very important battle in terms of, you know, the development of the French state. But beyond that, it also has become this symbolic thing of, you know, this is when France saved Europe from the Muslim tide and turned back the heretofore undefeated Muslim armies and blah, blah, blah. You know, realistically, probably it was about the outer extent of the range that the Umayyads could get to. But in the sort of romanticized version that springs up in the 18th and 19th centuries, much, much later, France sees itself as the hero that turned back the Muslim tide in Europe. You've also got the legacy of the Crusades, where the French had such a big presence because they basically needed to get rid of all these younger brothers who were going to be disinherited by the various Salic law and all that. You had all these French guys, these Norman guys going out across the Mediterranean, setting up these crusader kingdoms in the Middle East. And there was a point where there were so many French guys in the Middle East that the Muslim folks there and the Arab folks there were referring to everyone from Europe as Franks, right? So there's this long history of France specifically being the clash point with the quote-unquote Muslim world, which is not really a real concept, but, you know, in the European conception, there's this Muslim world. And, of course, in the Muslim conception, there's the European world or Christendom.
It's all unified.
Right. And yeah, obviously we are aware that it's not all unified, but we need to recognize that on the other side, it's also not all unified. But France has conceived of itself for quite some time as the civilizing, crusading force that defended the, you know, Europeanness. And so we're looking at that sort of historical context and historical viewpoint in the context of these rising anti-Muslim rallies and right-wing anti-Muslim political parties like Front National in France. And we're seeing that Charlie Hebdo is then sitting in all the middle of this, and instead of attacking, you know, instead of directing all of its attacks at, you know, the Front National or whatever, which they certainly did attack, right, they're instead continuing to put out these caricatures of, you know, black Africans or North Africans and Muslims of various, you know, origins. And they're saying, you know, they're using these old caricatures. And you look at that in the context of France seeing itself as sort of holding back the tide of the uncivilized Mohammedans or whatever, right? And that becomes a really huge problem. This is the context in which this is happening. And if we look at it in that context, it becomes a much bigger issue than just, oh, freedom of expression or people shouldn't take this so seriously. It's basically like sort of an embodiment and a symbol of this sort of systematic oppression that the French people have tried to do, you know, and they had colonies in Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco and Syria and Lebanon, and they were part of dividing up all these, you know, territories that are now all like blurring together and fighting as a result of ISIS and the Syrian civil war and the situation in Iraq. This is the context in which this is happening. You can't put stuff out there and think, oh, it's a vacuum, like there's no historical weight to this or whatever. You can't think, oh, people aren't going to view this as a symbol of my oppression.
Yeah, I would just point out that also that various French thinkers were pretty integral into the conception of sort of the third world and like this rising tide around sort of the Western Europe historical heart of, quote unquote, the world. And that sort of would be changing just sort of geopolitics, and this is back in the 50s where they started coming up with this, and obviously that's impacted various French actions since then. But just go back to Charlie Hebdo, it seems like looking at some of their history here, and it seems like over the past decade, and really since the 90s, they've sort of shifted far from the left, moving just pretty close towards the right. And I'm sort of thinking about if this in some ways is similar to things we've seen in America. Like, there have been many, especially when you think about the real radicals of sort of in the 60s, it seems like some of them became neoconservatives and, you know, were stridently, you know, anti-Muslim and things like that. I'm just wondering if there's a connection maybe, or just, it just seems like it's strange how you have these leftist groups and then all of a sudden they're shifting towards these, you know, sort of equally radical, but, you know, just xenophobic, walking the lines of racism, you know, trying to say that everything is about hatred towards, you know, the oppressions of the Muslim religion, but at the same time, that's not all they're targeting. You know, it's just sort of using that as a springboard to just take shots at everyone that they, you know, could find a reason to take shots at. And so, you know, that's a thing that's definitely concerning. Go ahead.
Well, I want to pivot from there. I think that's a good segue into the sort of comparison of where we're at on race in the United States, especially on the left, not just on the right, and also on Islamophobia. I think there's a lot of interesting parallels between what's going on in France and what's going on in the United States. You know, Nate kind of alluded to it earlier when he jokingly said, you know, there's no races in France, right? As an official policy since World War II, and part of this was a reaction to the fact that government records were used to help deport Jews during the Holocaust, they've tried to say, you know, we're not going to keep any official government records. We're not going to even ask the question, what race are you or what religion are you? We're not going to have any of those statistics. So a lot of those stats are sort of unofficial at best or derived from various, you know, external non-governmental sort of polling operations and things like that. Or there's various tricks like trying to figure out based on last names what somebody's ethnicity is, although you can't really necessarily rely on that either. But they've sort of come up with this concept that, oh, if we just say that there's no races and there's no different ethnicities, that we'll all meld into one multicultural, you know, national identity, that kind of thing. And that hasn't really proven to be the case.
But also, I don't feel like a lot of French people even want that necessarily. Like...
No, I don't think so either. I think behind closed doors, they're willing to, you know, use all kinds of slurs and things like that. I think that what we essentially see is instead of having sort of a melting pot identity, which is what we to some extent see in the United States, instead, it's basically how can we file off the edges of the people that stick out, you know, do those bans on headscarves and things like that, which is that's a pretty targeted thing to do and, you know, keep some people from being able to participate fully in public life. And instead of celebrating those differences, which, you know, not everyone in the United States wants to do that either, but you know, at least there's a little bit more of that in the United States. Instead of celebrating those differences, France is saying, no, you just have to conform to the very, you know, white-centric, historical European French identity. There is no room for expanding the notion of Frenchness. You have to go under the original model. And we're not going to call it that, but we're going to say, oh, yeah, everyone from different ethnicities all has the same identity, the old French identity. There's no room for a broader definition there.
Yeah, to take this back to the magazine itself, you just sort of wonder how things would have been different maybe if they, not different in terms of, you know, whether terrorist attack occur or not, but just different in terms of how we're thinking about them, if they had, you know, maybe joined with Muslim cartoonists in order to, you know, have really cutting satirical cartoons about various things in the Muslim world that, you know, it would be, you know, they various experienced Muslim cartoonists could bring sort of a personal touch or, you know, layers of satire that, you know, you might just not be able to come up with or understand really if you're not coming, you know, directly out of that politic. So, you know, you sometimes just looking at some of these covers, it seems like it's just shock value. It's just
exactly.
we're gonna run a cover. It's gonna be something to do with Islam. We're gonna have a cover with pregnant Boko Haram women saying they're looking for welfare, like something like that. That was a real cover.
Yeah, they said the girls that were kidnapped by Boko Haram as sex slaves. They made a quote unquote joking cover that with the exaggerated stereotypical features from old school cartoons that we might see 100 years ago of Africans, you know, with big lips and that sort of thing, and saying like, oh yeah, well, we don't think that they're welfare queens, but the French right probably thinks they're welfare queens. Like they always tried to frame it as, oh, this isn't what we think, this is, we're satirizing what somebody else thinks. But it's, you know, in the US context, we call this ironic racism. And the fact of the matter is, ironic racism is still racism, because until racism is actually over, you're just fueling it. You're just putting out another offensive thing into the zeitgeist. You're not actually, you know, subverting. Like, you know, if you want to make fun of the French right or, you know, the American right or something like that, you put them on the cover, right? You make them look ridiculous. You don't put their targets on the cover and do that. I mean, last year we saw when President Obama visited Belgium, they tried to say, oh, you know, racists think that President Obama, because he's black, sells weed and loves basketball. And it's like, okay, well, President Obama does love basketball, but you don't like put him as a basketball player because that's your only conception of,
according to his book, but
right, but like you
don't selling out of the White House,
certainly not, yeah, but you don't like, and they try to say, well, this is what racists think of him. Well, and it's just like, well, okay,
there was also that New Yorker cover where he was like doing the pound with Mrs. Obama and he was like Bin Laden or whatever,
right? Well, that was another
example. I like that cover. I thought that was hilarious because like if you don't get that one, then you're just like, okay, you're too stupid to,
but even that was like, that one was a little bit different, right?
It falls in this like general category. I mean, I thought that one, the reaction was a little over the top. It was part of it because it was election season and all that, but I don't know, I just thought that was a funny cover just because of the pounding it and whatever. But anyway, yeah, it just, you don't want to see this situation where we're simultaneously, you know, sort of mourning the dead and at the same time like criticizing the way that they went about their jobs in a way that got them killed. You know, it's like, this is really tough to sort of think about and talk about, but I think it's important that we not sort of just do a hashtag je suis Charlie, just talk about how, oh, it's so terrible and terror and, oh, it's so bad and kill the Muslims. Yeah.
The backlash that we've seen out of this is people saying like, oh, this is more proof that all Muslims are violent and must be purged. And it's like, well, congratulations for validating everything they were trying to get you to say so that they could recruit more people.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say one other point is that there is a French minister who said that she had been portrayed as a monkey. She's a black justice minister, Christine Taboureau, who had been portrayed as a monkey in the publication, and then sort of defended them afterwards, I guess, saying that free press is the enemy of the scourge and violence. So it's just sort of like, what are we doing here? It's like some of these cartoons, and just like I've been looking at a fair amount of them just in preparation for this show, it's not that they're like so offensive that it's just like overpowering, and obviously it'd be more offensive to a Muslim or than me or whatever. But I mean, I've seen worse cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. It's not like the things that were being portrayed here weren't necessarily like on some unique level, but it would just seem like sort of the attitude and sort of the just the way it was gone about, or just and the frequency of it, just like it had the wrong attitude.
To have a closing point here, you know, besides these comparisons of, you know, the French left and the American left thinking like, oh, racism's over, so we can make fun of the people for having racist views, you know, by basically repeating what they say and that kind of thing. Like, okay, well, that's not particularly funny or whatever, insightful, et cetera, et cetera. But also, like, they have previously in the past, they had fired someone for making what was perceived as an anti-Semitic joke. And we see that, you know, if you ran an anti-Semitic cartoon in the United States in a mainstream publication, like, that person's going to be out of there. And that's true in general in Europe as well. You can't run wildly anti-Semitic stuff. There's sort of a limit to, like, what sort of stuff you can do because it's not really satirical value at that point. It's just sort of feeding into hate and existing tropes and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, as we've talked about so many times on this show before, Islamophobia remains just a mainstream acceptable thing. There were publications that were running these cartoons like defiantly after this massacre happened, trying to say, you know, we're gonna stand up for the right to free expression and by publishing these cartoons that produce this reaction or whatever. And it's just like, okay, but you wouldn't print, you know, other wildly racist cartoons about other groups and things like that. Why are you doing it for this? And we see, you know, just mainstream people in the media, in politics, both in Europe and in the United States, they can just casually say stuff about Islam that's completely offensive, blur everyone together, paint with the broadest of broad brushes, and they just get away with it. There's no consequences. Nobody's suspended. Nobody's fired. There are no consequences. And that, to me, is one of the most disturbing things. It's not just that this, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing in this terrorist attack and they knew it was going to produce recruitment. They knew that this is the reaction that it was going to get, which was just mainstream people out and out rallying to defend this horrible publication with their horrible jokes and, you know, saying that this is what freedom of expression is, that Charlie Hebdo is the epitome of Western values, which it's not, but they're saying, like, everyone just walked into the trap that these terrorists set up, essentially. That's
and there are worldwide demonstrations are over this. I mean, it's everywhere. It's on Twitter. It's on, you know, people holding up various signs at games and stuff. I mean, this should be an opportunity to, you know, join together and express our sadness and just sort of come together. But I don't know. I feel like the Je suis Charlie thing has gone a little overboard considering what we know about this magazine. And the fact that, I don't know, I really wouldn't want to get too deep into bed with them considering some of the stuff they've written in the past. I mean, once again, freedom of expression is extremely important. But sometimes we can get caught up into this a little bit too much where we're just, oh, freedom of expression is important, therefore we can publish anything that we want, no regards to the consequences, say well, whatever we want about anybody, and then just sort of, I mean, express an attitude that is just not particularly welcoming or friendly to, you know, a decent part of the population. And it's really unfortunate everything that's gone on both before and after these tragic events.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me this week to talk about these stories.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.